It was awful. My thoughts, I can hardly explain. My heart thumped with fear and my face must have been white. Now was to lead and show an example to 20 men who carried 3 guns. I can never forget it. I prayed and all my hope was with him. At last the time was drawing near. I drew my revolver and placed my whistle in my mouth. I blew my whistle. I then gave a shout of forward. I dashed out along the railway line. I'd only gone about 50 yards when I tripped and fell. Hard luck, exclaimed some of the 55th Battalion, thinking I was shot, but I sprung up and rushed on. And I rushed bang into their barbed wire. I heard the bullets smacking the ground around me. Picking my way through the wire made me go slower, and I thought of the awful position I was in. Oh God, help me, were the words I uttered. I must have raised my head slightly when crash bang. It was a terrible smack. It felt like receiving a terrible smack from a cricket ball, but 10 times worse. It stunned me with a force, and for a moment I hardly knew how I'd been hit. Then the blood rushed out of my mouth and down my face in torrents. I was in agony, nearly choking every minute. I staggered on. The sides of the trench had been blown in, and here and there figures lay dead in all directions. Blood was everywhere. At last, we saw a stretcher coming. I fell on it, and they took a haversack from a pile of equipment and put it under my head. The stretcher bearers took up the stretcher and walked on. They were pretty tired, poor fellows, and they put me down every now and again. At last, we turned down the little aid trench, and they put the stretcher down. These were the words spoken by Sergeant J.G. Ridley of the 53rd Battalion of the Australian Imperial Force. And he was explaining the dreadful situation that he found himself on the evening, the early evening of the 19th of July, 1916, just over 107 years ago. And this was to be known as the Battle of Fromelles. And in this podcast that I call Tales from the Battlefields, we're going to be looking not at the history of that battle, but at the story of the men that went into action. We're going to walk across the battlefield to see what we can find. We're going to walk into the cemeteries on either side of No Man's Land. And we're hopefully going to try and understand what those Australians and some British men went through on that summer's day in 1916. But before we do that, we're going to travel once again to the Menin Gate in Ypres. I was there last week with 50 students, year 9 students, and most of them were 14 years old, from Northampton Academy. And with the aid of a grant from the Sir Thomas White Foundation here in Northampton, they were able to travel to the battlefields of Ypres. I took them to Lishenhook Cemetery. We went to Tynecott. Of course, we visited the German cemetery at Langemark. And then we went down to Vimy Ridge. But on our second evening in Ypres, we attended the last post ceremony at the Menin Gate. And 3 of those students from Northampton Academy were chosen to lay a wreath as part of the ceremony itself. And I took my microphone along and I interviewed, first of all, their teacher, Jason Rush. And then I spoke to the 3 girls themselves just before they laid the wreath. So let's go over to the Menin Gate and let's talk to those participants and see what they experience. What do they feel the battlefields tell them through the eyes of 14-year-old children? So this evening, I'm at the Menin Gate and we're doing a podcast. Do you want to be in a podcast? Right, okay. We're at the Menin Gate in Ypres, which has been covered in scaffold, as we know, but it's now been covered in, what would we call that? What's it covered in? Canvas, isn't it?
Yeah,
some sort of canvas. Showing the Menin Gate as it was. And I've been here these last couple of days with Northampton Academy from Northampton, 50 students from Northampton Academy. And we've been touring around the Ypres Salient over the last couple of days. Tomorrow we're going down to Vimy Ridge. But tonight, three of the girls are going to lay a wreath on behalf of Northampton Academy. And I'm here with Mr. Rush from the History Department at Northampton Academy. What brought you here in the first place then, Mr. Rush?
Well, it's really something that I did when I was at school. And when I became a teacher, it's something I was really determined to try and introduce as a trip for the young people of our school. So we first came out here in 2019, where we brought 45 students and did the same. And it's really gone from there. COVID, unfortunately, took a big impact, and we've not been able to organise and plan with different regulations and changes. So it's the first time we've been able to come out with from since then. And the big desire was to be able to get young people out of Northampton and bring them somewhere different to really try to understand the First World War, which is on our curriculum at Northampton Academy we've been learning about, and to put what we've learned into practice and see how it is from there.
And the people that we've brought out here, they're year nine, did you say? What age is year nine?
Yeah, year nine. So they're 13 to 14-year-olds who have come out here with us today.
And did you say that for a lot of the students, this was their first trip abroad?
Yeah. Some students, we've got a big proportion who have never actually left the UK, so this is their first time coming out. So that's why we're going to Vimy Ridge tomorrow. So they're actually physically setting foot in Belgium and France. Not only as, you know, remembering the First World War, but also having the experience of culture of two different countries, to be able to say I've been to two places, as well as now obviously getting a stamp in your passport to say that we've left the UK and entered the European Union.
And I know you've got a particular interest in the Great War, coming from Brackley. How did you get, what stirred your interest in the first place?
Yeah, so my interest particularly, I mean, I studied war studies at the University of Hull as an undergraduate, where I kind of pursued an interest quite fortunately academically. And then it kind of spread when one of my friend's brothers was sadly killed in Afghanistan. And when we all stood around the war memorial in Brackley with the 68 names on it and said on Remembrance Sunday that we will remember them, and I kind of read the names and thought, well, I'm saying I'm going to remember people. I don't know anything about them, so I made it then my mission to find out about them. And it went from there, really. So that was back in 2011, so it's about 12 years that we've been doing that.
And you've got family that fought? Family that fought in the Great War?
Yes, I have. Yeah. Two of my great-grandfathers came through the Menin Gate, one in the Royal Engineers, one in the Lincolnshire Regiment, when they came up through the front line in their various roles. And both were fortunate to survive the war, though one was quite badly wounded. And I had some great-uncles, too, that came through here, one in the Royal Artillery, one in the Royal Fusiliers. The two both suffered quite bad wounds that impacted them for the rest of their lives.
So they would have passed through this Menin Gate where we are today on their way up to the battlefield. And these last couple of days, what's been the highlight for you?
I think really seeing the young people engage from the academy. I've been really privileged to see the 50 students that got their places selected randomly, because we had so many interested in being able to attend. We couldn't bring them all. It was really fortunate to be able to see how well they kind of took on what's quite a difficult thing, even for us with emotions and understanding and looking around places like Tynecott and Langemark
to see the difference. Langemark was a real eye-opener, wasn't it, for those being in a German cemetery? They hadn't thought about that.
Yeah, they hadn't at all, and it really opened their mind to be thinking of them as human beings and not just an us and them, sort of the goodies and baddies attitude, and how that changed and what that developed and what that became. And Langemark can certainly ask some big questions when you see sort of unbegatten deutsche Soldaten. Of knowing, you know, there's five unknown there, but then also further down the list there's another three or four, and sometimes up to 21 in one small grave. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so it's a big eye-opener for them as well.
So moving on now, we've talked to Mr. Rush, the history teacher. I've now got three girls here that are going to be laying a wreath tonight at the Menin Gate. It's only about 10 minutes away, so the nerves are building. First of all, what's your name, please?
I'm Badriel.
Okay, Badriel. And what brought you here? Why did you want to come on this trip?
I wanted to learn more about the past and how maybe in the future how we can avoid this like devastation that we had in our past.
And do you feel as though you've done that today?
Yeah, I feel like I've learned a lot that I didn't think we could learn in like a normal history lesson. So
no, that's right. You have to come to the battlefields to see it. What's been the highlight for you during the last 2 days?
Seeing how like different countries celebrated and kind of grieved. Yeah.
Because I know you were affected when we were in the German cemetery at Langemark, weren't you? What did you think there?
The way that there's two different versions of like, how to commemorate. It was, when it came to the Germans, it was more dark.
Dark, yeah.
It's more, yeah. And when you went to like the British cemeteries, it was more hopeful.
Yes.
So two different ways to do the same thing. Yeah.
What's your name?
Sky.
And Sky, do you know why you
Mr. Well, so I've only been out like the country once when I went to Spain, and I felt ill that time, so I didn't get much of experience being out, so I was really excited to come here to be able to get like more of like an experience of what it's like being in like a different country and that, and sort of see like how they live and that sort of stuff.
And what's been today and yesterday, what's been the highlight? What's been the best point for you?
I quite like going to the cemeteries, but I do have to say going in the ferry was by far my favourite so far, because it's really cool, yeah.
And that's what it's all about, isn't it?
Yeah.
If you have fun, then you're going to learn about things, aren't you? That's what
you've
discovered. Have you thought of anything to say
I remembered it. What's the question again?
first question was, what made you want to come on this trip in the first place?
Well, it's been a while since I've last been on a school trip, and I thought this was a good chance to finally go somewhere at school. And plus, I've never been to Belgium before, so I thought it would be a good chance to experience a new place.
And tomorrow we're going to France, of course. Have you been to France before?
No, not even that either.
And you were doing something very special in Tynecott Cemetery, because you were going around looking for particular soldiers. Can you explain why that was, without giving your name away?
I was looking for my last name, just because I wanted to see like who was could have been part of my family. I just wanted to see what they've done and who they were.
And how many did you find with your family name?
I think I found around three. There was a fourth one, but I couldn't find him.
We found the New Zealander one, didn't we?
Yeah, found the New Zealand one. He was difficult, though.
So do you think we're going to go down and have a look at those soldiers and see perhaps who they were and see whether maybe they were related to you?
Yeah, I hope. I will try.
Excellent. Do you think you'll all three come back to eat one day?
Most
likely. Definitely.
Yeah. And there's other battlefields to go and see as well. Well, it's now nearly 8 o'clock, isn't it? What's the time? It's about 8 minutes to 8. And then in 8 minutes' time, you're going to perform something that not many people have done. You know, you've been chosen out of 50 students from your school, from Northampton Academy, as your guide. It's been a very special privilege for me to bring you over here and to show you around. And you three have been most interactive and have asked most questions and have done so much. That's why you've been chosen to do this. How does that make you feel?
I'm not happy about it.
Are you proud to represent your school?
Yeah, of course.
Okay. So you know what you've got to do. You're going to go forward. You're going to lay your wreath. You're going to stand back, a little bow, and think of all those soldiers that you've looked at today, and you're doing it in their memory. So thank you, and good luck. So the ceremony here at the Menin Gate has just finished and people are beginning to filter away, and indeed in a few moments we'll be boarding our bus and going back to our hotel, which is about half an hour away. But after I finished interviewing those three girls there, the ceremony took place. They went forward with the wreath. They laid the wreath just as they practiced, just as they'd rehearsed a few minutes earlier. They didn't know until about 15 minutes before they were been chosen out of 50 students to do it. And I must admit, having spent the last 2 days with these young people, they've responded so well. They've all come from different backgrounds, but they've responded so well to all the information that we've given them. What we did at Tynecott today was to give them an envelope each with a soldier in, a photograph and a biography. Some of the soldiers were remembered on the Tynecott Memorial in amongst the 35,000. Others had graves. And they all went off to find their particular soldier. Some of them it took a lot longer than others. Some of them we needed to help a bit, some we didn't. But all of them attacked that task with enthusiasm and they bought into it. And they spent about an hour and a half in Tynecott. And it was one of the most rewarding things. And then to see them, those three girls, lay the wreath just then, the way they did it, the way they composed themselves. They were nervous, as they would be when you're 14. But honestly, I'm saying this now, just a few minutes afterwards, it actually brought a tear to my eye of pride. I don't know these kids. I didn't know them at all till yesterday. I've been into school a few times, but I hadn't met them. To see them do that, see other children do that, it makes you realise that children, young people, are interested in remembrance. They're interested in what these men and women did during the Great War. And hopefully they'll take that away. Not all of them will, you know, out of 50. Some are not interested. Of course they're not. They're just here for a trip out. But a lot of them are, and a lot of them have changed their attitudes over the last 48 hours. Tomorrow we go to Vimy Ridge. There'll be another experience there. We're going to take them to France. So they've been to France and Belgium. And hopefully more people will take on that spirit of remembrance that we're promoting whilst we're here in Ypres. Very different experience. Usually I bring groups out to Normandy with Ledger Battlefield tours, or with Terry's tours, family tours. This is the first time for several years I've done a school trip, and I can honestly say it's been one of the most rewarding and emotional experiences of my life, and hopefully there'll be many more. We're now on the bus going back to our hotel, and I was previously, just now when we was at the Menin Gate, I was talking about the students and how impressive they were. I also wanted to talk about the teachers. There are five of them on this trip with the 50 children, 50 students, and it's really opened my eyes to the hard work that the teachers have put into this trip. It's no easy task looking after 50 14-year-olds with all sorts of different needs and different behaviours. And they're on the go. The teachers are on the go during these trips 24/7. Even during the night, they've got to make sure there's nothing untoward going on, which is what they've been doing. They keep their eye on the kids all the time. The kids know that they're doing it. And it really has made me understand and appreciate the good work that teachers do when they bring students on these tours, because it's not easy looking after them. They have to make sure they behave at all times. They're representing the school, they're representing themselves, representing our country. And especially at the Menin Gate, their behaviour was impeccable. Really does make you proud, but special mention to those teachers from Northampton Academy. So it's now a few days since I returned from that trip, and I've thought about it quite a lot, and hopefully listening to that, if there's any teachers from secondary schools in particular in the United Kingdom or even further afield that are listening, hopefully now that the fears of COVID are over, you'll be encouraged to head to the battlefields with your students, probably next year now, and discover exactly what those students from Northampton did. So now let's head to Fromelles. I visited that tragic battlefield in March of this year, and I travelled with two podcast listeners that had come over to Europe from Melbourne in Australia, where of course many of the soldiers that fell at Fromelles also came from all those years ago. And their names are Michael and Susan Wyatt. It's a very small battlefield, so we toured the battlefield and we talked about some of the soldiers that fell, and we visited the places where they're buried. So without any further ado, let's go over to Fromelles and see what we found. So today is a very cold, windy, almost stormy day, and we've come to a place that is so important to the people of Australia, and it's often referred to as a forgotten battle. It's the Battle of Fromelles, which was fought over a 24-hour period, really, between the 19th of July 1916 and the 20th the next day. And it was fought by Australian and British forces on that evening. And the aim of the operation was to seize a 3.6-kilometre stretch of the German front line, which is where I'm standing now, and a fortified redoubt, which is behind me, called the Sugarloaf, which was a salient stack out into, as a redoubt rather, it stuck out into no man's land. It was hoped that this action would prevent the Germans from sending reinforcements, 50 miles further south to the Battle of the Somme, which had begun nearly 3 weeks earlier. The operation was an absolute disaster. At the centre of the attack, neither the Australian nor the British infantry, attacking across this wide reach of no man's land, managed to reach the Sugarloaf. Hundreds of men were killed, wounded or shot by German machine gunners who had survived the seven-hour artillery bombardment. And the Germans from the high ground on Auber's Ridge behind me could see the build-up to this battle. They knew it was going to happen. They could see the Australians packed into their assembly trenches, and of course they put down an artillery bombardment, so many of those Australians were killed or wounded before they even got out of their own trenches. And when they did, they were hit by their own artillery bombardment as well. Now, a section of that German line was seized by the Australians, but the Germans were able to work their way around the flanks and into this vulnerable position by early morning on the 20th, the Australians were forced to withdraw to their original positions. But even that wasn't going to be possible because the first line that the Australians had taken, they didn't hold it. They moved on to the second line. The Germans got back into their original trenches, made it very difficult for the Australians to withdraw. Many were cut down as they tried to withdraw back to their own lines. At the end of that 24-hour period, it was discovered that the 5th Australian Division had suffered as many as 5,533 dead and wounded in just that single day. German casualties were relatively light, I think there was 1,600, and the battle had no effect whatsoever on the Germans' ability to send their forces further to the south. And as we walk round this very small memorial park, there's the remains of, what, 5 German pillboxes that were here. Some of them have been very badly damaged by shell fire. Some appear to be completely intact. And the ones that we can see into, we can see water showing us that here in this position, the water table is just below the surface. And at the centrepiece of this memorial is a wonderful sculpture called Cobber. As the fighting ceased at the battle here on the 20th of July, hundreds of wounded lay in no man's land. And then for 3 days and three nights, men ventured into this area despite the enemy fire to bring in their wounded comrades, often carrying them on their backs. One soldier who was particularly active in rescuing the wounded was a Sergeant Simon Fraser. And he was with the 57th Battalion of the Australian Imperial Force, and he was from Victoria, the state of Victoria. And on one foggy morning, as he was bringing in the wounded, he heard a distant call. And those words that reached his ears said, "Don't forget me, Copper." Fraser and some others went back into danger, and they brought this man who had called out to him, and also another wounded man. They brought him safely in. The courage and compassion which the Australians showed at Fromelles in looking after their wounded comrades is therefore commemorated in this beautiful sculpture that I'm looking up at the moment. And it was designed by a man called Peter Corlett. It depicts Sergeant Simon Fraser rescuing that wounded man of the 60th Battalion. And this unit, the 60th, they suffered greater loss than any other Australian unit at Fromelles. And when the battalion assembled for roll call, only 166 men answered their names out of 887 who'd gone into battle on the previous day. It's a very sad and lonely spot here. It's very flat. It's impossible to imagine that those Australians had to cross 400 yards of no man's land where there was absolutely no cover whatsoever on a beautiful summer's evening. There's only us here now. I'm with Michael and Susan Wyatt from Melbourne. They've come all the way around the world to see this and other Australian sites here on the Western Front. It's now raining, it's freezing cold, but we don't care, do we, Michael?
No.
What does this place mean to you? We might have to make a run for it in a minute because the weather's closing in.
This place is very emotional. It's the worst day in the military history of Australia happened right here. 2,000 dead, 24 hours, 5,500 casualties. It's just a very special place to come and visit. Makes you feel very, I don't know, lots of emotions.
You're so far from home, aren't you? And the conditions, the whole, as we came into Fromelles, Susan, your wife, said how different this landscape is to what you know at home. Yeah. And it would have been very different for those men that fought here.
Yes.
Because they'd only been here a few weeks and they weren't ready for it. They weren't trained, were they? They were really let down by their commanding officers.
Yeah.
And I suppose is this story told at home in Australia?
Fromelles is relatively unknown still, which is a shame. A lot of the Western Front and our involvement there is still relatively unknown, especially in comparison to Gallipoli, which is the focus. The average Australian wouldn't really know about this at all, where we are right now. You have to be very much interested in the history to know that. But I find that quite a shame because this is a significant place in our relatively short history as a nation.
Yeah.
So Yeah, most people wouldn't be aware, but to think that in the field we're looking at, just looking out there, the suffering that happened.
So many of those chaps are still there, aren't they? They're still in that ploughed field that we're looking at in front of us. That was no man's land.
Yeah.
And on the other side of no man's land is the VC Corner Australian Cemetery.
Yes.
And that's going to be our next stop. We're going to wander over there, and then we're going to go to Pheasant Wood and see what we can find in the newest, the most recent of the Commonwealth War Graves Commission cemeteries.
Yes.
It's going to be an emotional morning, isn't it?
It will. It will. And despite the rain, it's just amazing to be here. It's just great.
Let's go and see what we can find then. So where we've come to now is 200-300 yards where we were on the German front line. And it's a very special place, very different cemetery, if anyone's been here. VC Corner Cemetery. It has been described as a very sad and desolate place, and it does feel like that today because it's a freezing cold day. The wind is sweeping across this open land, and the rain is sweeping in on and off as well. And it's set amongst the flat, featureless farm plains of this part of French Flanders. And this cemetery, it does have a feel of a lost island in someone described as a silent sea. And for the years that this has been here, getting on 100 years now, not a lot of people tend to stop here. But it does have a very special place in Australia's past. And it's the only cemetery, the only Commonwealth War Graves Commission cemetery in France that is solely for Australia. It's also the only cemetery without headstones. There's no epitaphs for us to walk along. There's no lines of headstones for us to walk along. What we've got is simply a stone wall inscribed with the names of 1,299 Australians who died in battle and have no known grave. And in front of me here, there's two plots marked by a large Christian cross and surrounded by rose beds. Roses, it's too early in the year, they're not yet out. And they are the unidentified remains of 410 of those Australians that died here at Fromelles that are buried in mass graves under these two grass plots. We don't know who they are. No doubt their names are on the wall behind me. Some of them have had graves that have been identified for them now, in particular the ones at Pheasant Wood, which we're going to go and see later. So the wall is now the point of commemoration for 1,171 Australian casualties. And Michael and his wife Susan, at the moment as I speak, are quietly looking at the names, no doubt looking for names of men that came from Melbourne, their home city. It's difficult, as always, we always say this, it's difficult to imagine the horror that went on in just that 24-hour period. We look across this empty, featureless area, really. There's a few trees. You can see the Cobber Memorial that we just went to. Apart from that, a few small villages, some farmsteads, and nobody around. I've never seen anybody here. I've been here three or four times over the last 20 years. I've never seen another tourist here, another battlefield tourist here. So it's nice to bring some Australians here to this place today that means so much to them. Just a few hundred yards behind the Australian front line is a beautiful cemetery, a moated Commonwealth War Graves Commission cemetery, and it's called La Trouille Aid Post Cemetery. In October 1914, the British soldiers serving in this area began burying their fallen comrades beside a regimental aid post and dressing station that was situated not far from their support trenches. It's a unique cemetery. It was designed by Herbert Baker, a celebrated British architect. He also designed the Indian Memorial at Neuve Chapelle. And today there's more than 350 Commonwealth soldiers of the First World War that are buried here, but over 200 of them are unidentified. And we're going to have a wander around that cemetery now and see what we can find. And as we do so, first thing that we notice as we cross the moat into this stunning cemetery is that there are three workers for the Commonwealth War Graves Commission. You can probably hear the humming of their lawnmowers as they're keeping this beautiful cemetery in the pristine condition that we've got used to. And as I cross the moat, I look down into the water and I see daffodils on either side of a shelter as we enter this cemetery. And the first thing I see when I enter the cemetery is the cross of sacrifice with a downward pointing crusader sword. And we're surrounded all the way around by this moat and willow trees that are just coming into bloom again. And as we said, there's over 350 headstones here in the corner underneath one of these weeping willow trees. Is one single French Christian cross right in the corner of the cemetery, and I see there's another one in amongst the British Commonwealth headstones. And as we wander around these lines, there's no daffodils yet, there's no summer flowers. Actually, I can see some daffodils that are beneath one of the headstones, or in between two headstones. Not many summer flowers have started to appear. It's too early in the year, but I'm now looking at a row of, 25, 30 unknown Australian soldiers. And these will be the men, no doubt, that died just across the way there on the Fromelles battlefields. These are your countrymen, aren't they, Michael? Yep, men, you know, and we know that these are Australians because when they found their bodies after the war, they have found their cap badge or something, but we don't know who they are. Their names will be on the Australian VC memorial that we've just been to. But these are the men that died in those fields that we just visited. And then behind them, there's a row, and it just says a soldier of the Great War. We don't even know where those soldiers have come from, but, you know, they're all someone's brother, husband, son, aren't they? And it's so important to come and visit them. What a beautiful cemetery this is, isn't it? The sun's coming out now as well.
You can tell why lots of people say this is perhaps one of the most beautiful cemeteries you can come to. It's just stunning.
It is, isn't it?
And the gardeners are here working. And
yeah. You've been here before, haven't you?
Have been here before. And it's as beautiful as I remember standing here.
Quite remarkable. And I noticed just over there, you can see there's just two headstones just by the cross of sacrifice, and there's daffodils that have come out. And I always think that daffodils tell us that the winter is over and there's some hope for summer. And maybe here it's given us hope for, I don't know, civilization perhaps? I don't know what it means. It's just me rambling. I usually wander around these headstones and try to look for family inscriptions. But with so many, such a large percentage of these men having no inscription, we don't know who they are, there's no family inscriptions to look at apart from those immortal words, known unto God. I don't know what I'm thinking when I'm here. There's a hedge on the far side of the cemetery behind the cross of sacrifice, and they are special memorials to five soldiers that they know are buried here, but their graves have later been lost. So they're, no doubt, their bodies are beneath one of these headstones that says, known unto God. Not just Australians. We've got soldiers here from the Worcestershire Regiment with a date of death, the 10th of May, 1915. So that would be the day after the Battle of Albers Ridge, which took place just 2 or 3 miles away on the 9th of May 1915. It was a battle that has a special place in our family history because my grandfather was awarded the Distinguished Conduct Medal for his actions in that battle. And as I walk on the far side of the cemetery, there are more Worcestershire men from that date, the date of the Battle of Albers Ridge, the 9th of May 1915. There's some Scottish there from the Black Watch. Oh, and we've got a Brigadier General here, Major W.G. Lowry Cole, CB, DSO, Royal Welsh Fusiliers. And he was commanding the 25th Infantry Brigade in that Battle of Albers Ridge, the 9th of May 1915. And he was 54 years old. So don't tell me that he was 30 miles behind the lines in a chateau somewhere watching the battle unfold with a glass of whiskey in his hand, because at 54 years old he was killed in that Battle of Albers Ridge. We'll have to find out more about him and tell his story. Those five special memorials that I mentioned are all memorials to men who died on the 9th of May 1915. During the Battle of Albers Ridge. And one of them is a second lieutenant, A.W. Bourke, from the Royal Irish Fusiliers. He was 23 years old, and his family chose the family inscription. It says, "This precious life has been given for freedom, honour, and the love of our country." and it says, God is love. So we've now come to the most recent of the Commonwealth War Graves Commission cemeteries, and it's a cemetery called Pheasant Wood, and in the distance behind me you can hear, maybe it's 12 noon, is it? Is it 12 noon? Yeah, it's 12 noon. The sun has just come out, and there the church bells of Fromelles ringing, and this cemetery is the final resting place of 250 Australian and British soldiers, and 101 of them are still unidentified. But the cemetery was built following the nearby discovery of six mass graves in 2008. And what happened then, after they found those bodies in the pits, they carried out an extensive archaeology examination of the graves, and that examination took place here between May and September 2009. And the bodies of the 250 Australian and British soldiers who died during the Battle of Fromelles were painstakingly removed, along with over 6,000 artefacts. Samples were taken from the remains and sent for DNA analysis, and these were compared to samples given by families of men who they believe were amongst the missing of Fromelles. And each case was carefully examined, and a significant number of identifications were made. And then in January and February 2010, all but one of the 250 men were buried here with full military honours, and the last soldier was laid to rest during the service to dedicate this cemetery in July 2010. And as I said, it's the first new Commonwealth War Cemetery to be built by the Commission since the 1960s. And there's one story that's shown on the information board outside the cemetery, and it tells the story of a private Alexander Stanley Clingan. And he was from Newtown in New South Wales. Before enlisting, he'd worked as a boilermaker's labourer, and he was one of those men that was killed, 2,000 men that was killed during the Battle of Fromelles here. His mother mourned his death for the rest of her life, especially saddened that he had no known grave. Now, Alexander was one of the first soldiers that was identified from the Pheasant Wood graves. His distant cousin, Margaret Clingan, writes, she came here to France to lay a poppy and a eucalyptus leaf from her Australian garden on his grave. We're going to go and see his grave in a minute. And we've also come here to look at the story of two brothers, Wilson brothers, that died at Fromelles and that were found and are now buried in the cemetery. But unfortunately, the cemetery itself is not in a very good condition, is it? When you consider that it's the newest, it's flooded, basically, as we enter it through the entrance porch. We get the cross of sacrifice in front of us, and then the 250 graves arc round us. But I would suggest that most of these graves, if not all of them, it's going to be difficult to go and see them because it's almost a sea of mud. And there's a notice that the commissioner put up to say that renovation is in progress. And it just shows the work that the commission have to carry out when they're forever fighting the weather, the natural conditions here in northern France. It changes so frequently. Just in the last 10 minutes, we've had horrible cold winds blowing across the open ground, and now the sun's come out and it's beautiful. But at the moment, this cemetery isn't beautiful because, well, it's just so muddy. But we're going to go and find out what happened to these Wilson brothers. Two brothers together. Now, there were, in fact, three Wilson brothers. Samuel, who was 30, Eric, who was 19, and James, 17, and two of them are buried here. They all joined up together. Samuel and James had adjusted their ages, claiming to be 29 and 18, respectively. James also required parental consent, which was given by his father. Now, these young men were the sons of George and Isabel Wilson, and they were from Port Macquarie, okay. Which is in New South Wales, I think, isn't it? I've been there, yeah. Now, despite joining up together, only Samuel and James left Australia on the 2nd of November 1915 on a troop ship. Sam and Jim had consecutive service numbers, and they were allocated to the 3rd Battalion sailing for Egypt, and where they underwent further training. Now, they were treated for mumps whilst they were there. That was a frequent problem for the Australians in those early days, very contagious. And they were transferred to the 53rd Battalion, post Gallipoli, to fill the gaps in that battalion. Now, Eric remained at the Liverpool training camp until he sailed out in March 1916. And shortly after his arrival in Egypt, he was allocated to the 53rd Battalion, and that reunited the three brothers again. Now, they left Egypt on the Royal George ship. They arrived in Marseille. They arrived there in June 1916. And from Samuel's last letter home, it seems that these travels in foreign lands were all still marvellous adventures for the three Wilson brothers. There may have been some forced cheerfulness. And I've got a copy of that letter here that he sent home. And he addresses it to his old mother. His old mother. She says, "Since I last wrote to you, great things have happened. First, we've left the land of the Pharaohs, and after a beautiful trip, arrived in France. I could not adequately describe the country in which we are. It is more lovely than I ever dreamed of. As you pass along the railway, there's nothing for miles but vineyards and orchards laden with fruit and divided from each other by the most beautiful hedges." He must be talking about the south of France, isn't he? "The houses look so nice with their red-tiled roofs and their little flower gardens in front. Further on, we came to open fields, and for miles as far as I could see, we could see wheat and oat crops mingled with red poppies, blue and white cornflowers. At other places were immense hills and lovely woods. One in particular took my eye. It was a little chateau, but close to the river, and behind there was a beautiful wood, and along the riverbank, the most lovely garden. After a good train journey, we were quartered for a week in a little village not far from the firing line. We had a good time there, undergoing final preparations and enjoying a good spell." So they're full of enthusiasm at this stage. Yeah. Then he says, "We're right in the thick of it. And I can tell you frankly that he's not one quarter as bad as I expected. Our boys are a splendid lot and a credit to Australia. We were under fire the other night and they were as cool as cucumbers. Each man at his allocated task like an old soldier. All the boys are well and as happy as songbirds." So this is obviously before that terrible battle here at Fromelles. But then we have a telegram. This is a letter dated the 16th of April 1917 from a private tailor, and he's in hospital in Rouen, and he said that he saw Private S.C. Wilson, we're looking at his headstone, killed on the 19th of July. The informant said that Wilson was in B Company and came from Port Macquarie. He was a bomber in the Fromelles attacks. He held at bay a German party, attempted to come down a sap, while a number of other men were killed to get away. He held the sap all alone and was himself killed by a bomb when the others had safely got away, and the informant believed he was recommended for some decoration for his heroism. But there's no decoration on his headstone. Now, there's no record of what happened to his brother Eric, who's buried next to him, but he also died on that same day, and the army made this formal finding after a court of inquiry some months later in March 1917. Now, both Samuel and Eric were listed on the German death list, dated the 4th of November 1916, and their identity tests were actually returned to the military authorities, which means the Germans, at that stage, we know they must have buried them. And the family received those discs in February 1920. Yep. So official files show there were significant delays in news confirming the fate of the three brothers, because we've only got two brothers here. There's one missing, isn't there?
Yep.
Jim's missing. It seems that the family had not had official confirmation of Eric and Sam, and there was no confirmation as to what happened to Jim. Jim was wounded in the neck during the battle. He was missing, and he was in no man's land, it turns out, for 10 days. With no ceasefire, it was impossible for either side to rescue their wounded, and James was eventually found and recovered from his injuries, and he returned to his unit where he served to the end of the war. And James, or Jim, returned to Australia in March 1919, but his mother had died the month before. So she'd lost her two boys out here, and she never saw the third one when he returned. While James was in London convalescing, he met Catherine Stanton. He married her in Sydney in 1921, and they had a son, and they called him Eric in memory of one of the brothers. Now, James went on to become a successful businessman, and he died in 1959. Now, when these two boys were buried here, 14 members of the extended family, they came to the dedication ceremony on the 19th of July 2010, on that anniversary, all the way from Australia. Wow. Now, the work that was done by, how do you pronounce his name? Lambis Engolos.
Yes.
He was the man that found the mass graves. And it rekindled the interest in the Wilson family, and they registered with the Australian Fromelles Relatives Database. Preliminary research indicated that Sam and Eric were probably buried at Pheasant Wood, and subsequent research and DNA samples confirmed that theory. And not only that,
the Germans had actually buried them side by side.
Oh, wow.
So they must have died side by side, unless some kind German would have realised they were brothers, but they probably didn't. Was that a coincidence or a compassionate act? We'll never know. Yeah, family were advised in March 2010 that the brothers had been identified and buried side by side where they are now, and they're basically sharing a grave. And we've got a photograph here of those three boys. There we go. There they are. There's James on the left, Samuel in the middle, and Eric. James, the one on the left, is the only one that survived. So the story of three Australian brothers, two of them were buried here in a mass grave for all those years from 1916 to 2008.
That's why they're still buried alongside, because all of these, when they were reburied next to the one they were found in the mass grave.
So they haven't split them up.
So they haven't split them up when they've reburied them. So these boys have been laying next to each other from the day they died, which is
amazing.
Amazing, yeah.
And on both headstones is the same family inscription. It says, in proud memory of Eric, or Samuel, loved brother, dear son of Isabella and George, rest in peace with Sam. And of course the other one says, rest in peace with Eric. And they were the words that the family would have chosen in 2008.
Gives you goosebumps.
It does, doesn't it? It's a cold day, but it made us feel even colder, isn't it, when you look at, especially when we could look into their photos, we could look into their eyes, and I'll put a photograph of the family, the three boys, on the on my podcast page on my website.
14 members of the family.
14 members came here, One was 30, one was 20 years old.
The one footnote, or additional story, really, from our wander around those cemeteries was the Brigadier Colonel that I found, Lowry Cole, that I mentioned. I've discovered what happened to him, because it was during that battle at Auber's Ridge that there was absolute chaos. His unit was ordered to retire, or they thought they'd been ordered to retire, but he himself jumped up onto the parapet of his own trench and succeeded in restoring order. But whilst he was doing this, he was mortally wounded. There's also a connection between the Battle of Frommel and my hometown of Northampton, where I'm sitting recording this podcast now. Just a couple of miles away, there's a Commonwealth War Graves Commission plot within the civil cemetery on the Toaster Road. And buried within that cemetery is a soldier from the 54th Battalion of the Australian Imperial Force. And his name was Private Roy Doust. And his story is his battalion, the 54th, were met by machine gun fire as soon as they moved out of their trenches. They did in fact take the German trenches, but they were hit by their own artillery as they chased the fleeing enemy. And of course the German counterattacks came in and it forced them back to their original positions. And Roy was one of 288 men wounded within his battalion. 77 men were killed and there were 173 reported missing. 8 days later, arrived at the Duston War Hospital in Northampton that the locals know as St Crispin's. His father received several telegrams about his son's condition, and within a month he was improving. In mid-October of 1916, he developed kidney trouble and he died on the 30th of October, aged 23. His funeral was held at the Toaster Road Cemetery on the 3rd of November. He's buried in amongst several other Australians, and they were all buried with full military honours. At home, back in Australia, his family were devastated because they were planning a welcome home party. And what makes his story even more tragic, that he went into battle that day alongside his cousin Willie, was killed in action that day. His identity tag was returned by the Germans to the Australians and it went back to his family, but they had no idea where Willie was buried or if indeed he did have a grave. But he did have a grave, because he was one of those 250 that were found in 2008, and he's now buried in that cemetery at Pheasant Wood. And in 2014, he was identified by DNA. Both soldiers had come from a place called Lower Southgate in New South Wales, and had no doubt grown up together. Roy was 22 years old, and his cousin a couple of years younger at 20. And there's more news. The battlefield has Frommel is still giving up its secrets all these years later. Those 250 men buried in the Pheasant Wood Cemetery, they're still over 50 of them that have not been identified. But now you can reduce that number by 7, because 7 more have been identified by the Australian authorities. And on the 19th of July, just last week, the anniversary of the ill-fated attack, all of these 7 soldiers that were previously commemorated on the VC Corner Memorial, their names were added to their headstones, so that these 7 men now have a permanent resting place. Well, they did anyway, but we now know who lies beneath those headstones in Pheasant Wood Cemetery. And I'm grateful to a podcast listener who was once 40 years ago, more than 40 years ago, my teacher. And he now lives in Sydney. And he sent me a copy of the Sydney Morning Herald. And it gave us some more details about the soldiers, the 7 soldiers. It tells us that one of them was Oscar Bauman, 20 years old, a joiner from Adelaide. William Stephen, aged 28, a grocer from Sydney. And Richard McGurr, aged 27, who'd come off the family dairy farm in northern New South Wales. Alexander Page, aged 28, was a milk carter from Perth. Walter Grace was 23, a labourer from Brisbane. And Edwin Gray, 30 years old, worked as a driver and a chauffeur before he made the journey from Riverton in South Australia. Maurice Claxton was 24, a horse driver from Western Victoria. He was killed while his younger brother Theodore was captured that day by the Germans. In the September of 1916, their father John had received a postcard from his youngest son advising that he'd been taken prisoner. There'd been no update by the military authorities about his brother. In a letter home, Theodore said he didn't know where Maurice got to, even though he said, "We were together until we made the charge, then we got separated." Now, Theodore survived. He returned home in 1919, but his brother's, Maurice's fate remained a mystery for all of these years. Luke Claxton, he was the great-nephew of Maurice. He set out to research the history of the two brothers following the death of his grandmother, and after contacting the Fromelles Association, his father was asked to submit a DNA test. And he said it all went from there, really. "I didn't realise the importance of this battle until that moment. It's probably something that more people should know, what happened there and what they went through." Another soldier, Corporal William Billy Stephen, was described by a comrade as a good man who acquitted himself very well. His mate James O'Brien, who witnessed his death, said Stephen was in one of the trenches taken on the 19th, where he was shot through the head as he stood by my side. And his relatives in Canada received an email last year asking if they would provide a DNA sample to confirm it was Stephen. They didn't even know they'd got Australian relatives. They do now. I've used one or two personal accounts during these podcasts, and they're taken from a book called Simply Fromelles 1916 by Paul Cobb. And here's one, an account written by Sergeant Les Martin, who's the 8th Machine Gun Corps. And he describes the battlefield at the end of the advance. He says it was ghastly, shell holes everywhere. Fires were still smouldering, dead bodies lying in all directions. Some without heads, other bodies torn about minus arms or legs, or pieces cut clean out of them by shells. One chap who had been wounded was crawling to safety, was killed by a shell hitting him right in the middle of the back. The shell was a dud. There was a man called H.R. Williams. He said that they tried to get out into no man's land with the agreement of the Germans to bring back in their wounded, but the request was turned down. He said, "So we had to see our wounded lying there to suffer the torments of the damned. They called out unceasingly for help and water. The sun and flies persecuted them. Those of them who were able to crawl were sniped at by the Germans. One man almost in front of our bay crawled inch by inch towards us, drawing a badly wounded POW with him. He got within a few yards of our parapet when he was fired upon by a German sniper. The two of them took shelter in a shell hole and called to us for water. A bottle was filled and heaved over the parapet to them." In contrast to the Australian sector, the line opposite the British 61st Division, the Germans appear to have cooperated with the British. The 2nd 5th Gloucesters, one of the units given the task of clearing the dead and wounded, recorded in their history, "The lot that fell to the Gloucesters was a depressing task of bringing in and burying the dead. This operation took 3 or 4 days to complete, and it is notable that the Germans allowed the stretcher bearers bearers and others to wander about no man's land in broad daylight, picking up the dead and wounded without firing a shot. One of the Australian commanders that day was a Brigadier General Elliot, and he recorded an atrocity in a letter home to his wife a few days after the battle. He said there was one poor fellow lying close to the German trenches. Our watchers saw a German come out and thought he was going to help this poor chap, but instead he deliberately put a bomb against him and blew him up. When they saw this, our men opened a lot of fire on the German, and he was unable to get back into his own parapet, but hid in a shell hole until dark. I'm afraid we did not get him, though, which is a great pity. There was a Captain Zonder, and he mentioned another incident. He said a Boche officer found wounded in the old Hun front line by a young Australian officer. The Hun made a gesture that he was wounded and unarmed and asked pitifully for water. The Australian officer unfastened his water bottle and slung it over to the Hun, keeping a little distance away from him. The Hun bent down to pick up the water bottle, which had fallen at his feet, and as he did so, he whipped out a revolver and fired point blank at his would-be benefactor. Luckily, the shot missed, but not so the Australian officer's shot. Another account explains how the Germans' guns fired an incendiary device into a melee of men. He says one poor wretch who had his arm blown off by a shell was crawling painfully across no man's land when one shell splattered him with its burning contents. He was seen to be frantically trying to smother the flames eating into his flesh. His screams could be heard for a second or two, then silence. We passed his body the next morning, one side cruelly charred and burnt. When talking about the Australians on the Western Front, we usually turn to their official historian, Charles Bean. And he said the scene in the Australian trenches, packed with wounded and dying, was unexampled in the history of the AIF. He said it was burned into the mind of everyone who saw it. And then 3 years later, Bean went back to the battlefield. It was Remembrance Day 1918, and he said, we found the old no man's land simply full of our dead. In the narrow sector west of the Lays River and east of the Sugarloaf Salient, the skulls and bones and torn uniforms were lying about everywhere. I found a bit of Australian kit lying 50 yards from the corner of the salient, and the bones of an Australian officer and several men within 100 yards of it. Further round, immediately on their flank, were a few British. You could tell them by their leather equipment. And within 100 yards of the west corner of the Sugarloaf Salient, there was a small party of English too, also with an officer. You could tell from the cloth of his coat. The story is that the ground around Fromelles was never fought over again. Fromelles wasn't taken until the armistice came in 1918. So who was to blame? That's not for this podcast. This podcast is to tell the story of the battle through the eyes of the men that were there, and hopefully we've done it today. The history books discuss who was to blame. The generals seem to blame each other. The Australian blamed the British and so on. That's for historians to discuss outside of my remit, outside of my understanding, to be honest. I only understand the stories of those men that went into battle on that summer's evening, July the 19th, 1916. So thank you once again for tuning in to my podcast. And next week we're going to feature once again the Australians, this time during the battle for Poisier Village and the Poisier Ridge and down to Moquet Farm. And this week, whilst we talked about the Northampton Academy's trip to the Menin Gate, we played The Last Post there. So for once, we're not going to play The Last Post at the end of this podcast. We're going to play something different instead. I'm going to play a song written and sang by a man called Peter Campbell from Australia, and he called this song The Lost Soldier. And he says it's based on the life of James Stephen Farrell, who was killed at the Battle of Fromelles. He said the song is dedicated to all the brave souls who gave their lives in service of their own country. I've looked him up, and James came from New South Wales, and he's one of those Australians that's still there, and he's remembered on the VC Memorial. And therefore it's to him and all those other Australians, British and German soldiers that died at Fromelles that we dedicate the podcast this week.
country boy from New South Wales, a fettler on the tracks, headed for adventure beyond the great outback. He signed up with his mates in answer to the call to fight another battle in someone else's war. He promised he would write as often as he could. Months went by without a word, and no one understood. Out there at the homestead, leaning on the rail, his father stood each afternoon, waiting for the mail. And no one knows what happened to the boy from Werris Creek. He sailed off for adventure, the world at his feet. We know he did his duty, and he didn't die alone. We were waiting there for Jimmy, but he never came back home. Every little town, the people line the footpaths to watch them marching down. The streets are filled with old men, memories and tears, stories told between them for those who can't be here. No one knows what happened from Werris Creek. He sailed up for adventure, the world at his feet. We know he did his duty, and he didn't die alone. We were waiting there for Jimmy, but he never came back home. We were waiting there for Jimmy, but he never came back home.